Okay, so this is the re-recording of Esther chapter 6. We are going to cover a bit of a good chunk of our story today in Esther. So we're going to go ahead and read chapter 6, verses 1 through, let's go 1 through 5, 6, sorry. Okay, on that night, the king could not sleep. And he gave orders to bring the Book of Memorable Deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, "What honor or distinction has been bestowed upon Mordecai for this?" The king's young men who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." And the king said, "Who is in this court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, "Haman is there, standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So Haman came in, and the king said to him, "What should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?" And Haman said to himself, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" Okay, so as we get into verse 1, Esther 6, verse 1, on that night, the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the Book of Memorable Deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. So on that night, it just so happens, we are going to see a lot of coincidences in this chapter. Now, in the world, we would call them coincidences, but we know as we've studied the book of Esther that they are certainly not just coincidences. They are the providence and sovereignty of God being put to work. So we are, let me just pull up. Sorry. Okay. So we are seeing this first coincidence is that Xerxes was unable to sleep. So on that night, he was unable to sleep. He couldn't sleep. And we see this as not just a coincidence, but a divine providential act of God that he was unable to sleep that night. It doesn't give us reasons as to why he was unable to sleep. It could have been that Esther, in her kind of stringing along these feasts in what she was going to ask him, maybe he was wondering what she was about to ask. Now, this is the third time that she has asked him to a banquet, and I'm sure that she's piqued his interest a bit. So we can also see that where it says that the king could not sleep on that night. So in the beginning, it just emphasizes the parallel between the closeness of the two events from previous. So in chapter 5, verse 9, it says, "And Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart." And so then here where it's saying on that night, it's just emphasizing that these two events happened consecutively. It wasn't many days in between. It was just immediately following that night. We've seen in previous chapters, months and years pass through, but here it indicates one day. So the king's insomnia is coincidence or God's providence, number one. He just so happens to not be able to sleep the night that Haman plots to impale Mordecai. Now on to the second part of verse 1, it says that he gave orders to bring the Book of Memorable Deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. So coincidence number 2 is the king orders the Persian annals. Remember back in chapter 2 where Mordecai saved the king's life from these two eunuchs who were plotting against him to assassinate him. Mordecai goes and tells the king that, well, he tells Esther, who tells the king, that they were plotting against his life. And as we've stated before, in the Persian culture, it was immensely rewarded. It was going to, that should have been something that was immensely rewarded. The king's always went to great lengths to make ensure that people were rewarded so that the loyalty remained, right? Because we know that if they are rewarded, it will encourage the kind of having the king's back, right? So they would have also recorded these things. They liked to talk about the history of what the happenings of the day. They liked to record victories in war. They would record special events and moments. And so they would have definitely recorded those who had been loyal to the king in saving his life. Like we said before, we know that this wouldn't have been the only time that there was an assassination out on the king. There would have been many other times that assassination attempts would have been made. And so we do know that they would have recorded such things in their chronicles to remember. So coincidence number two is that the king orders the Persian chronicles to be read to him. Now, we've seen, this is now, we're into after the 12th year, I believe, if I remember right. Yes, we are after the 12th year of the king's, King Xerxes being in charge of the empire. So there would have been many, many books to choose from to read the happenings of what was going on. So coincidence number two is that he so happens to have the eunuch who goes and fetches the chronicle happens to choose the one that had a very significant story to our story today. And it's interesting that he chose to be read to out of all of the things he could have chosen in his sleeplessness. We know one of his favorite pastimes is drinking. We know that he has plenty of women to play with in the harem, but yet he still chooses to read from his chronicles. Now, whether he was choosing to read from the chronicles because he thought it would put him back to sleep, I'm not really sure that that's an honor, because these were supposed to be honorable things that had happened throughout the empire. So it's a little bit ironic that he chose that. Or did he choose it to maybe boost his pride a little bit in the middle of the night? We're not sure. But he would have had many things to choose from pass through his sleeplessness, right? Because we knew that he had many women in the harem to be able to please his sensual desires. But yet, the coincidence or God's providence is that he chooses to read from the chronicles. Let's see here. The court document could also literally read the record of his reign. The ESV translated it as Book of Memorable Deeds, and then NASB records it as the Book of Records or the Chronicles. So this word in Hebrew would have been, I'm going to try to say it, hazikronot. The root of this word means to remember. So this indicates the records were not only just memorable or noteworthy, but they would have also included just even the recent current events. So it was a vast array. All right, moving into verse 2. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So here we see coincidence number 3. Not only does he choose the chronicles to be read, but now the servant is the one who seems to be picking out what is going to be read. And out of all of them, the servant reads the story of Mordecai informing the king of Bigthan and Teresh's plot to assassinate him. So we see, again, God's providence in choosing out this very specific story that this very night, there is a plot against Mordecai's life, right? And we saw that Mordecai, back in chapter 2, he was not honored the way that he should have been honored. The Persians made an effort to honor him, and in God's providence, he was not honored at that time. And I'm sure he kind of wondered, why wasn't I honored? And what's even worse is in the very next chapter, the writer tells us in the very beginning of chapter 3 that Haman was edified to the high position of second in throne. And so here, Mordecai had just saved the king's life and not been given any honor, but now honor is being bestowed upon someone else In the very next chapter, it just is a distinctive contrast of the two, and it kind of shocks us that Haman comes out of nowhere and is promoted to this position. So now here we have the king on a sleepless night being pulled out a chronicle, and now the one of the stories that is read to him happens to be about this Mordecai who saved the king's life but was not honored, and now the king is going to wonder. So it piques his interest, because likely the reason he asks the question is because nothing was honored. I am actually just re-recording from last week because my recording didn't take.
Oh.
Yeah. We are. Yep, but at 10. Yep.
Oh, at 10.
The prayer meeting? Prayer meeting or the Bible study?
Bible study.
Bible study's at 10. Yep, it's always at 10. Oh, prayer meeting's at 9 or 9:30, I think, but
Yep. Well, can I just sit and listen?
Sure.
Because I wasn't
sure.
Here.
Sure. Go for it.
That would be nice.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I've just gotten through a couple verses. So now I'm in chapter 6. I'm doing chapter 6 because that was what we did last week. So I'm just re-recording it.
Okay.
Yep. Yep. And I'm on to verse 3 right now. And if you have any questions, feel free.
Then I went to let the dogs out, and I must not have locked, or somebody didn't lock the kennel real tight.
Oh, no.
Puppy.
Yeah.
Two puddles in the dining room.
Oh, no.
Okay. Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
Don't get in a hurry.
Bummer.
Doesn't help.
Yep. All right. So, yep. Chapter 6, verse 3. Xerxes is asking, he wasn't able to sleep, and so then he asked the servant to come and read him from the Chronicles. We're seeing a lot of these coincidences in chapter 3, which, I mean, you could say coincidence, or you could actually see it as God's divine providence, right? That these certain things are happening. So in verse 3, Xerxes is asking what honor is given. So verse 3 says, And the king said, "What honor or distinction has been bestowed upon Mordecai for this? The king's young men who attended him said, nothing has been done for him." So, being in Persia, it was important for those men to be honored. And now it's not recorded here that Mordecai was honored. And so that's why he asks what honor or recognition was given. So this is another act of God's providence that it wasn't recorded. Honor and recognition, honor and recognition would have resembled the king's glory, and it was a common practice for them to share their privileges with those who proved themselves loyal. So this was an opportunity for the king to show his immense generosity in honoring Mordecai. This verse also indicates that he was served by his servants day and night, because the servants were immediately there in his sleeplessness to be able to serve him in any way. So then on to verse 4 and 5, it says, "And the king said, who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the kings about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, "Haman is there, standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." All right, so here we have another coincidence or act of God's providence. At the very moment that Xerxes is considering how to honor Mordecai, Haman, the enemy of Mordecai, is noticed in the court. This indicated that it was probably early morning. Haman, the day before, we saw that Haman, speaking with his wife, had said, "You should go right away in the morning." So obviously Haman didn't waste any time in going right away in the morning, probably the early crack of dawn, to go in and petition to the king why he wanted Mordecai to be hung on the gallows, because he needed to get the king's approval. So he was raring to go right away in the morning. He wanted to get there before anyone else got to the king, so that he could get this taken care of. So at the very moment that Xerxes is considering how to honor Mordecai, Haman comes in, and Xerxes sees him. The king, it says that the king... Let's see. Oh, and even here in verse 4, just in case the reader missed the irony, they wanted to ensure the reason that Haman was there was to speak to the king. So just in case you hadn't seen it in the previous chapters, they're placing it here so that the irony of what we're about to see transpire in this rest of this chapter and the end is so significant. He's saying he's there to speak to the king about having Mordecai hung on the gallows that he had prepared for him. So then verse 5 says, the king's young men told him, Haman is there standing in the court. And the king immediately says, let him come in. So I thought it was interesting that with Esther, she was so worked up to this point of coming to see the king. She was so fearful that it could mean the loss of her life, even though she was the wife of the king. It's very interesting to me that there doesn't seem to be any indication of Haman that he is at all fearful of coming before the king. So there may have been an understanding that because he was the second in command, he was a high official, it could be just an understanding that he was allowed to be in the presence of the king. But it's just interesting that not even the wife had that privilege, or at least from what Esther understood, she did not have that privilege of being able to just come before him freely. Without fear of her life being in danger. Haman seemed to be pretty confident that his life was not going to be in danger. He went before the king, and it says, and Haman is there standing in the court, and the king immediately said, let him come in. And he, you know, nodded to his men standing there with their axes and said, go ahead and let him come in. All right. Okay, verse 6. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman said to himself, well, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? So here we see another coincidence. We see another act of God's providence that Xerxes doesn't even stop to ask Haman why he's here so early in the morning and, you know, what he's here for. With Esther, he immediately asked her. He knew that she understood the gravity of her coming uninvited, and he immediately knew that that probably meant there was something wrong. So Xerxes right away asked her, what is it? You know, he said, I'll grant your request up to half the kingdom. Now here with Haman, I think it's a divine act of God that Xerxes didn't first ask Haman, why are you here? He just immediately played off of what he was thinking, which was how are we going to honor Mordecai? And so I find that quite ironic that he immediately asks, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? Now here again, he does not use Mordecai's name, so Haman has no idea and assumes in his pridefulness that the honor is for him. It's the honor's to be given to him because in his right mind, he's thinking, as he stated, who else in the kingdom could Xerxes possibly honor? I'm second in command, so of course it's going to be me, right? There's nobody else who is greater than me. He's put me as second in command, so of course he's going to honor me. And, you know, we know that Haman's idol is being honored and being seen by others to be honored, to be of the most high honor. Let's see here. Yeah, Haman's pride yearned for the utmost praise. Let's see in my notes where I skipped over a few things. Haman, obviously, he thinks very highly of himself. He's prideful and self-observed in his thoughts to just immediately assume that it's him that we're talking about. And here we see this epic misunderstanding, right? This setup is happening of this epic misunderstanding. You can just picture in Hollywood, they've derived a lot of their scenes from movies, probably from here, because it's just this confusion about who they're talking about. What's also interesting is the question that he asks Haman and how he words it. He says to Haman, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? Back when he was talking to the servant, the king said, let's see, where is it? Verse 3, the king said, what honor or distinction has been bestowed upon Mordecai for this? So that where it says honor or distinction, he is attributing two things. That distinction could also read promotion. If the king had used that same phraseology when he was speaking to Haman, if he had said to Haman, what honor or distinction, or in other words, promotion has been bestowed upon, or what promotion should I give to this man? It could have clued Haman in that, oh, he's trying to not only honor, but also promote somebody to something. And that may have clued Haman in to the fact that, well, he couldn't possibly be talking about me then, because I'm already promoted to second in command. Where else would he be promoted to? So then it would have, it's another act of God's providence that he didn't say specifically that distinction of recognition of promotion, because then Haman would have figured it out already, that it wasn't talking about him. So I just find it very interesting that it was two different, you know, things that Xerxes used, essentially asking the same question, but he worded it differently the second time. And I believe that's absolutely God's providence that he did it that way. We're just setting up for this epic misunderstanding. All right, and then on to verse 7 through 8. And Haman said to the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let the royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" We read through verse 9. So here in verse 8, Haman starts to describe how the honor should be given. Right? So he's saying, let the royal robes be brought that the king has worn. So it's not just any of King Xerxes' robes, not just anything old thing in his closet. He wanted it to be what the king had worn. Right? Then it goes on to say, and then the horse that was to be ridden, it had to be a horse that the king would have ridden, not just any royal horse that would have done any royal thing, but the one specifically that the king would have ridden. And then there would have been a crown on the horse's head that would have signified that this was the king's horse. So he wanted to ensure that that specific detail was not left out. Now, on top of this, they needed to be led by the king's most noble officials. So these would have been the officials who would, it's like the secret service of the president, right? These are the people who would have stood by the king to waltz him around the city. These would have been the men that the public would have recognized as the bodyguards of the king. Now, all of these things, the specific robes that the king would have worn, the horse that the king would have ridden, the officials that would have protected the king, if these were the things that would have clothed the man that the king was honoring, when that person being honored would have been walking through or riding through the streets on this horse, and when the people looked upon that man, what would they have seen? They would have seen the king, because he was dressed as the king, he rode the horse as the king, he was with the king's officials. They would have seen the king. So, in essence, what is Mordecai trying to say? Haman. I said Mordecai. What is Haman trying to say? Haman wants to be the king. He wants the ultimate recognition of having the king. And now, somehow, Xerxes does not see this as a threat, because in Xerxes' mind, he's viewing this as the honor of Mordecai rather than Haman. But you would have thought that maybe he would have been threatened that Haman was trying to take the honor of the very king himself. But we've seen that Xerxes doesn't think too deeply about a lot of things. So it's not surprising that it kind of went over his head. So we are not surprised by Haman's flamboyant suggestion. Haman is asking for royalty and all of the frosting with it. Haman wants to ride the horse that the king has ridden. He wants to wear the royal robes. He wants to be the king. Okay, then on to verse 10. Then the king said to Haman, "Hurry, take the robes and the horse as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned." You can just picture Haman. It probably just feels like a knife in his heart, because the very thing that he wanted for himself was now going to be bestowed on the enemy, the very man who he was coming to the king to ask to be impaled on the tree. So you can just imagine Haman's horror when he hears Mordecai the Jew, and Xerxes makes the distinction, not just Mordecai, he says Mordecai the Jew who sits at the king's gate. So this is ensuring it is the one Mordecai, the specific one. It isn't just any old Mordecai in the empire. This is the Mordecai that Haman was trying to eradicate. And Haman is told to make haste, and he is not to leave any bit out. Not a single bit. Every single thing that he said needed to be done. The other interesting thing is the king said to Haman, he didn't just go and ask a servant to go and do this. He asked Haman to go and do this. You, Haman, are to go and dress Mordecai in those royal robes. You, Haman, are to go and find my horse and with the crown and get Mordecai up on the horse. You, Haman, are to lead him out into the streets, proclaiming, "This is the king. This is the man who the king delights to honor. You, Haman, are to do this." Verse 11, so Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." So Haman goes and takes him out into the city, and he has to say, just as we said, you can just imagine how bitter that must have tasted in Haman's mouth to have to say that about Mordecai. Verse 12, then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. Now, I would have thought, being Mordecai up on this horse, watching Haman lead me around the city, having to proclaim that this is the man that the king delights in, that Mordecai maybe had a little bit of a smirk on his face as he was leading him through the city, that, oh, na 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 na, like, I'm the one that the king delights to honor. But verse 12, there's no indication of Mordecai, that Mordecai even really cares. It just says he returns back to the king's gate. He just returns back to his job. He doesn't seem to really think a whole lot of, or at least from what's recorded, he doesn't care too much about this honor that's been bestowed upon him. He just returns back to the king's gate. But in turn, Haman turns away in mourning with his head covered. And we've seen in these previous chapters, in chapter 4, right? Yeah, chapter 4, where Mordecai tears his clothes and he walks around in ashes. Now here, that was for the mourning of the death that's going to come to the Jews. Now here, Haman is in mourning, and he has his head covered due to his own grief of shame and humiliation. He's not concerned for anyone but himself. He's concerned for his own honor and glory. And so he is mourning this humiliation of having to, I mean, his wife and the friends who gave him the advice of killing Mordecai, they would have seen, most likely, him parading around Mordecai. And it would have been embarrassing to watch his friends watching Mordecai being honored so greatly. And so how embarrassing. So Haman hurries away in mourning and with his head covered. Then verse 13 says, and Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. So I suppose they didn't necessarily see, but there's no indication as to what all this means, everything that happened. It could be that he's retelling what happened in the palace when he went to the king to go and try to tell him that he wanted to impale Mordecai, and then, you know, the epic misunderstanding. So he goes and tells Zeresh and his friends everything that happened. And his wife Zeresh then says to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but surely fall before him. So now suddenly, you know, the night before, just the night before, actually, I mean, this was maybe less, this could have been 12 hours ago, 14 hours ago, that she had just given him the advice to go and impale Mordecai. Now suddenly she becomes this theological bearer of news saying, if Mordecai really is a Jew, and then you have no luck, because it would have likely been that she would have recalled the history of the Jews over and over and over again being saved by their God. She knows that the Jews have this special place with God because of history, right? She's seen it happen. Or I shouldn't say she's seen it, but she has heard of it. And now she is literally seeing it before her eyes take place. So maybe last night she didn't really believe truly that the Jews had this special God on their side. But now she is her husband, second of command, now be dishonored in a sense, and this other man be honored. So she's watching it happen before her eyes. She's seeing that they really do realize the power of the God of Israel, and that he has elected and chosen this race, and he will carry out his promises through them. And she, as a pagan, is even acknowledging that this has taken place. And it's interesting that she, as a pagan, would even acknowledge this, because even the Israelites, the Jews, when they were fasting, there's no recognition of them giving the you know, doing that on behalf of God. They just decided to fast out of the sake of maybe ritual. But yet here, even the pagans are acknowledging the power of God over Israel. When Martin Luther was asked what argument he could use to prove the Bible was true, he answered, the Jews. And I thought that was just such a mic drop moment that, of course, we see over and over for thousands of years the Jews have been preserved. And to this day, they have been preserved after so many nations being eradicated. And yet this tiny little nation still remains to this day. It's just absolutely incredible. All right. And I also said in the beginning, sorry, let me just find where we are in my... Oh, verse 14, there we are. While they were yet talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. So, remember, I said, pay attention to the eunuchs in the very beginning of our intro, I said, pay attention to the eunuchs in this story. When accompanying the Jews, it was for their benefit, and when accompanying the Persians, it was to their demise. Remember, Vashti was fetched by eunuchs, and then she was disposed from her place as queen. Esther was brought about by eunuchs, and she was given lavish treatment, and she had extreme favor by the eunuchs. Now we see the eunuchs ushering Haman to the feast with Esther, and it's kind of this dun-dun-dun-dun moment of, I am sure Haman's wife's words are ringing in his ears, that if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. And I'm sure as he is being rushed away to Esther's banquet, that is ringing in his ears, wondering, what is his fall, or what is his doom, or what is the next moment's going to bring about? Just some final thoughts on this chapter were, as I was thinking about it, this passage poses a serious warning to those who are unwilling to bow the knee before God. Haman's fall was not predictable by human standards. He had it all: fame, wealth, position, and honor. Yet in the space of less than 24 hours, he was disgraced and dead. Spoiler alert for the next chapter. God said back in Genesis 12, I will bless those who bless you, and I'll curse those who curse you. And in Genesis 13, it says to oppose the seed was to be an enemy of God and his promise. So Haman has set himself up to be an enemy of God. And now he is going to go from the second in command. He, from a worldly standpoint, we would look at someone like him and think they've got it all. He's got fame. He's got wealth. He's got honor. Everybody idolizes him because he's in this high position. And yet, he goes from this prestigious position to being disgraced and then dead in a span of 24 hours. That seems just otherworldly. It doesn't make sense in our human world, but yet that's the way God works, right? In his sovereignty and his providence, he worked so far outside of us. If we are relying on our own goodness for a minute, we are in serious trouble. Nothing short of perfect obedience offered from a heart of a pure motive meets God's standard. And all who fall short are under that curse. Our fall could be just as sudden. We could be taken from our comfort to face a holy God. Are we ready for that? So, what's in the middle of even our own day? You can just imagine. Two friends sitting down to have coffee, talking about the events of all of the craziness of what's going on in our time. And you can imagine even back then, two friends sitting down and saying, what's going on? You know, I mean, the empire is just, it's a little bit crazy. The king just honored sent out a decree to annihilate all the Jews. And now he just honored Mordecai the Jew. That seems a little bit odd. And then did you see who was parading around the Jew? It was Haman, that evil Haman. So I'm sure they were probably bewildered, just as we often today are just as bewildered at those who are in power and authority in our government. We sometimes sit back and wonder, are they even competent to rule? It seems like things are just out of whack and going crazy. It sounds certainly familiar to what we experience today. And we ask ourselves, what in the world is going on in our country and in our world? And what's the answer in the middle of all that craziness? I really think we see it here in Esther. God knows exactly what he's doing. Alistair Begg said, he exalts who he chooses to exalt. He uses the freedoms, the foolishness, the sins of our feeble humanity in order to bring about his plan from all of eternity, so that all things may be united. And do we believe that? For yourself, do you believe that even in the quiet moments, that he uses every bit of it, not just the good, he uses every single bit of it to further his purpose and his glory? And I'm so grateful that he does, because I'm so grateful that that means that even my life can be used, and that even in my life, he can be honored, because he is going to use it all. I will close this in prayer quick, and then we will be done. Lord, we just thank you so much for your word. We thank you for the ability to get to be in the word and to study it freely. Lord, I pray that we would take every opportunity to seek it out, Lord. I pray that we would rest in your providence and your sovereignty as we are seeing it played out here in Esther. We are seeing you use people who did not necessarily show such perfect faith. They didn't, but yet you used them in a mighty way for your glory to be revealed, even to the pagans. So Lord, I thank you that the God that you were here in Esther is the same God that we serve today. And I'm just so grateful for that hope. In your name we pray. Amen.